Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia. Today I'm bringing to you Professor Julian Zarath from actually two places. So her main position is at the Karolinska Institute, where she has a senior position there. And also she's at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. So, you know, across two universities in two different countries with senior roles in both. So she heads up an institute at the University of Copenhagen as well. And Julian has a very interesting background. I mean, that's interesting enough already. But as part of her role at Karolinska Institute, she was actually voted by her peers to, at one stage, be the chair of the Nobel Prize Committee. So I think that's pretty remarkable. Julian's, you know, as you'll see, very modest about that. But I think it's quite remarkable for someone who's an exercise physiologist who, like myself, was at Ball State University in Indiana with David Kostel. During her master's, and you'll see this is the second out of three in a row of people that are associated with Ball State University, to go from that through to these amazingly prestigious university roles, and then to chair the Nobel Prize Committee. I think it's pretty amazing. But Julian has a very impressive background in exercise research. Her main interest is insulin sensitivity in muscle and how that is reduced with diabetes, and also how this can be improved with exercise. And she's looked at all sorts of things, and of late has been looking at circadian rhythms. So the effect of, the time of day, shift work, changing time zones when you fly, for example, on your metabolism, similarities and differences between people with type 2 diabetes and people with, that don't have diabetes, how exercise can impact on this, also the effect of the time of day on exercise, metabolism, and performance. So I think it's a really important and interesting chat. So stick around.
Hi, Julian. Thank you very much for coming on Inside Exercise. How are you?
It's great to be here. Yeah, great to be here. Glad we can actually get this together, this time together, and we're on the same day, the same calendar.
That's exactly right. So it's 6 p.m. for me, and you said it's 10 a.m. for you.
That's now, right, 10 a.m., yep. But now the weather's really different. Here it's 0 degrees. It's probably warm and sunny by you.
Oh, it's not too bad. But yeah, it's definitely warmer than that. So you get around a lot. And that's partly what I wanted to talk about is you've got, you head up a lab in Karolinska Institute in Sweden, but also the University of Copenhagen. Now, what I'm interested in is where are you actually at the moment? And how did you actually end up? You're an American. How did you end up? Which I think that's right. You are an American. How did you end up on that side of the woods and doing so well?
So I'm at the Karolinska in Stockholm, Sweden, and that's my base. I live in Sweden. I live in Stockholm, or an island in the suburb of Stockholm. Mm-hmm. And I've been primarily at the Karolinska since 1989. And I came over to do my PhD work. I mean, you and I have had some parallels in our careers. I started my career at the University of Wisconsin at River Falls. And there I studied physical education and teaching. And in parallel, I did a degree in business administration, actually. So it was two different tracks. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Ball State in Muncie, Indiana, and did a master's there. And that was great. That was really a lot of fun. And from there, I went to Wash U, and I worked with John Halazi as a research assistant in his lab. And that was a pretty phenomenal environment, because John had like the downstairs lab where a lot of the work was focused on mechanisms controlling glucose transport in muscle and how exercise can promote glucose uptake by an insulin independent effect. And that was before we even had the glucose transporters in the hands, And then John had this upstairs lab where it was really applied physiology and clinical physiology. And a lot of the work there was translating what we did in the downstairs lab where I worked to the upstairs lab, where John was working with people with diabetes and people of different ages and trying to understand the health promoting benefits of exercise. And I think probably inspired by David Kostel, actually, at Ball State, I really learned a lot about the Scandinavian researchers and P.O. Ostrand and Bank Saltine and all these great, you know, Scandinavian physiologists. And in Halazi's lab, Harriet Walbrook Henriksen was there and she was working on glucose uptake. And I just figured, why don't I go to Scandinavian? You know, Abe Katz had done that. Abe Katz had been at Ball State.
Yep.
And he went over and did a PhD with Kent Sahlin. And Eric Holtman, you know, and I talked to Abe a lot about that and thought, well, you know, if Abe had done that, and he really, really was promoting the Scandinavian research environment. So I did my PhD at the Karolinska around John Warren and his team and Harriet Walbrook Henriksen. And then from there, I went to Boston and did a postdoc with Barbara Kahn at Beth Israel Deaconess, Harvard Medical School.
You've had some good background there. Really
phenomenal environment to be in because, you know, sitting there every single time, you know, every day we had a seminar that we went to, and it was usually research that was going to be published a couple of years later. So you were
every
sort
day
of,
you had a seminar. Wow.
Well, you know, there was things that environment is so rich. You could have a seminar at the Joslin, or there could be one at Beth Israel Deaconess or Mass General. I mean, so there was so much emphasis on what's coming up, you know. So that was really a rich environment. And then from there, I went back to Sweden and I worked a little bit in Denmark at the Hagerdon Research Institute that was run by Per de Metz. And that was focused more on insulin signaling and insulin action and the genetics of diabetes. And started my own lab at the Karolinska in 1996. So pretty much there. And then how did I get to Copenhagen? I mean, in 2009, the dean of the Faculty of Health at the University of Copenhagen invited me to join a proposal. We were writing a proposal together with Olaf Peterson, Tui Schwartz, and Jens Jules Holst. And that idea was to set up a center for basic metabolic research. And that was funded in 2010. So from 2010, I've been working part-time at the University of Copenhagen, initially as a scientific director, and now I'm the executive director of that center since 2017. So I kind of divide up my days between, you know, my research at KI and running the center in Copenhagen, and I have a team of postdocs there. In fact, we just got off a Zoom call where we were discussing mitophagy in the
lab. Wow. So we kind of started off similar because I was at Ball State, I think you're alluding to, with David Kostel, which is amazing. And the number of people that have just been on this podcast, you know, so Andy Coggan was the first one on. He was there. Mark Hargraves, yourself. Hang on, I'm having a mental play.
John Hawley.
John Hawley. Yeah. Brett Goodpastner. Pretty sure he was, wasn't he? Yeah.
John Hawley and I were contemporaries, and John Kerwin was there, and he was a postdoc. We were there at the same time. Daryl Newfer was there at the same time.
Yes, he's on my list.
I'm trying to think. It was a really strong group of people. I mean, it was just phenomenal to be there. And it's fun to see how well all my colleagues have done.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, they've all gone on and they've really done fantastic things.
Well, that's the thing. I've had everyone pretty much has come on and said yes that I've asked that went to Ball State, except David Kostel. I can't get the great man on to myself. He'd be great. And he comes up probably every second podcast. So
he was so inspiring. I mean, he was just always so enthusiastic, you know, and he was just
such a sense of humor.
Yeah, a real character. I just loved his energy. And he had a way of taking these complex questions and distilling them down to things that really mattered for people that were trying to improve performance.
I'll tell you a funny line. So I did my master's with Dave, and then I came back and did my PhD with Mark Hargraves, and David Kostel came down. I was telling Michael Joyner about this last week, and we VO2 max tested this guy, Derek Clayton, who had the world best marathon time in 1969. We VO2 max tested him in 1990, and I was in charge of the Douglas bags anyway. And it was stressful, but we got it done. But the point was, we had this evening together, and my mum came out, and she was just like, "Ah, it was so wonderful. You changed Glenn's life." And he said, "Life? What life? He should be in the lab. He's a PhD student." It's just the sense of humor, you know. All right. Now, the other thing is, and this is amazing. I was thinking about this earlier. So with Mark Hargraves, he was at Melbourne Uni, and then he moved to Deakin, and he actually said, because he was in a medical school there, he said, "I'll never make full professor in a medical school as an exercise physiologist." Mm-hmm. And then that's the only time I know that he was wrong, because he actually did come back to Melbourne Uni as a professor. So the interesting thing, and this is the reason for me saying this, is that you ended up the chair of the Nobel Prize Committee in Medicine as an exercise physiologist, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a bit about that? You would actually ring up the people to congratulate them, is that right? To tell
no,
them?
No, I'm not the one that actually rings them up. So well, first of all, the Alfred Nobel was really clear in his will that the Nobel Prize should be for physiology or medicine should be decided by a jury of professors at the Karolinska Institute. And so initially there were, you know, all the professors at Karolinska Institute were on this jury. And now we have a jury called the Nobel Assembly, and that's 50 professors at the Karolinska Institute. And so I was elected into that assembly by my peers. Mm-hmm. And from that assembly, which is 50 members, they're the voting body of the prize. There's a working body called the Nobel Committee. And I was elected into that committee, and it's a 2x3-year term. And during that term, 1 year I was the vice chair, and for 3 years I was the chair of the committee. And basically the job of the chair of the committee is to really organize the work. Every year we get newly nominated candidates. Every year we start like with a clean slate. So the individuals have to be nominated in the year to be considered for the prize for that year. So we have several hundred individuals that are nominated every year, and we go through the nominations, and you know, we will get opinions from external referees or, you know, reviewers. We'll ask our colleagues out in the world to give us an opinion about the individuals who've been nominated, and we have to award a discovery. So we have to be certain that the individual who is nominated has made a discovery and that they're the person that made the discovery. And we generally look to see whether or not that discovery is a new paradigm or paradigm shifting. And clearly it has to be related to physiology or medicine. And so the job of the chair is to organize the work, and the committee then puts up a recommendation of the potential candidate or candidates for the prize for that year. And the assembly is the body that votes on who will be rewarded the prize. And the Secretary General, he is really organizing all the work. That's Professor Thomas Perlman. And he's the person who contacts the laureates and makes sure that everything around their visit is working in a good way. And, you know, he's the Secretary General of the whole organization.
Well, I still think it's pretty impressive that you ended up being chair of that committee. And I must get my stories wrong. You told me at one stage about someone rang up someone and they went there, or something about it was a funny story.
Yeah,
I
can't remember what it was. That's long before my time. Okay. Professor Jan Lindstein was the Secretary General, and he rang up one of the laureates. The hardest thing is to find their telephone numbers, because, you know, you can't nominate yourself. You have to be nominated by someone else. And we don't usually have people's home addresses or home phone numbers. And we actually don't contact anyone until, well, we vote on the first Monday of October. And so it really is only then that we're clear that we have the laureates. And we vote around 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning, Swedish time. And a couple hours later, we'll contact the laureates and inform them of the decision by the assembly. And so finding the phone number is always really difficult. And so one year, Professor Lindstein rang up the laureate that year and got a phone answering machine. And he said it was a gruff sounding man. And Jan Lindstein informed the phone machine who he was and why he was calling, and hung up the phone. And then he called the other laureate, who was the co-recipient of the prize that year, and said, you know, I just talked to your colleague, and he wanted to double check the number. And the other laureate had said, no, that's not the right number. Here's the right number.
Oh, so my gosh.
Called back the phone machine.
Some
and he said,
random
yeah,
guy won.
And again, and I just am calling to tell you that unfortunately you're not receiving the Nobel Prize this year. And then he called the true recipient and made it all
I'm
right.
I'm assuming so. That first person was not a medical researcher, at least. They might have been.
I don't
like
think
a,
so.
A lumberjack
I'm
or something.
I'm not sure what he was doing.
It would have been bad if they were a medical researcher.
He might have been. Jan Lindstein said he sounded like a construction worker.
There you go. Well, I'm glad.
Who knows what he was doing?
Hey, all right. So we're going to talk about circadian rhythms, exercise, and type 2 diabetes today, yeah? So as you said, you've had a background of looking at a whole bunch of stuff. So we've crossed paths a couple of times with some of the stuff with glucose uptake, AMPK. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to say, I think the last time I saw you was on a tram in Amsterdam. I think
it was, yeah.
Yeah, an exercise metabolism conference.
We sat next to each other for dinner, I thought.
That's right. And I was saying how I was having trouble getting my papers reviewed because I was saying stuff about AMPK that didn't fit with the party line or something. And I think you may have been, because you were at the time. Anyway, I think you might have helped me out a little bit there with assigning something on. Who knows? Who knows? Okay. All right. So let's talk about this. So how about we start off talking about circadian rhythms and type 2 diabetes? And then maybe, circadian biology and timing of exercise or the other way around. What do you reckon? Yeah. So
I'm really interested in insulin sensitivity. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm really interested in understanding how muscle cells become insulin resistant. And I'm interested in how exercise can help muscle cells remain insulin sensitive. So I'm really interested in that question. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that in the context of type 2 diabetes and obesity.
Yep.
And the other thing that I've become really interested in is rhythms and rhythms in metabolism. And I think it's just fascinating, that there are these intrinsic clocks that control metabolism in a diurnal manner. And to some extent, I think that biology is understudied. To some extent, obviously, there was a Nobel Prize for, elucidating this molecular circadian clock. So clearly, this is an area of research that's really important. But it's hard to study, and it's difficult to study because it requires an investigation of biology over the fourth dimension, the time dimension. And so, I suppose if you think about it, the endocrinologists understood rhythms and metabolism when they got the RIA, because they could study hormones, they could study circulating factors over the course of a day. You know, they could do this by blood sampling, and you could see these diurnal changes in hormones such as insulin or stress hormones, et cetera. And we know that many of these hormones are interacting with the core clock machinery, and they can fine tune or they can reset these clocks. They can be Zeitgebers, they can be timekeepers. And we know that there's changes in our physiology over the day, changes in blood pressure, there's changes in alertness, changes in heart rate, body temperature. And in terms of sports performance, there's times of the day where we're stronger, usually afternoons, and greater alertness in the morning. So I was just interested in how do you actually put that whole time spectrum onto the daily changes we see in metabolism. And then the next question I really wanted to bring forward was, could we then somehow utilize the environment, exercise, to interact with this clock machinery? And could we use exercise to fine tune or maybe reset some of these circadian clocks? Could exercise be a Zeitgeber? And would that be a way in which we could restore rhythms in metabolic diseases? Because we know that, if you think about this metabolic flexibility, this was Kelly and coworkers, they talk about these changes in substrate switching throughout the day. And people who have normal glucose tolerance are very metabolically flexible, and people who have diabetes are metabolically inflexible. So there's a rhythm in metabolism. So can you use exercise to kind of reset that rhythm? And that's kind of how I came into these questions. And initially I contacted Paolo Sassoni Corse, who has passed away, but he's been a real, major force in circadian biology related to metabolism. And then I contact John Hawley, who obviously, as you know, works a lot on performance aspects, and Harriet Wahlberg Henriksen. And we put together a grant to ask whether or not we could fine tune the circadian machinery and metabolism by exercise and diet. So that's kind of how we got into these questions.
Yeah, it's good you mentioned diet right then, because I was thinking, you know how you say it's a little bit hard to study, because it, I don't know if you know, we did a study looking at like shift work, which we'll talk about later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you sort of go, well, how much of the effect of the shift work on insulin sensitivity, for example, is the fact that they're eating at different times, or they tending to eat more fatty foods, and you know, they're not as active and they're not sleeping as well. And, you know, so it sort of becomes complicated, but we'll probably get to that later.
It's complex. So, yeah. I think that's the word. It's very complex, yeah. Because clearly nutrients, metabolites and hormones can interact with this clock machinery for sure.
So yeah, I was wondering if we could set the scene a little bit for people. So how much of what's going on is this sort of the clock? So if you maybe explain how there's like clocks within cells, and it's not just, you know, the brain's releasing melatonin, because people know about melatonin and things like that. I wonder if you can just set the scene a little bit about how there's like the central control with melatonin and nerves, and then there's also the peripherals and how they interact, you know. Complicated, I guess.
Right. So nearly every cell in the body has an intrinsic molecular clock. Mm-hmm. And you could think about it in this way, that all organs then have a clock. So there's the central clock and the suprachiasmatic nuclei here. And that is the clock that is sensitive to light. And, you know, obviously that is getting light cues. And the light is one of the biggest zeitgeisters we have. And that central clock is sort of, if you think of an orchestra, that central clock is the conductor of the orchestra. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you think of muscle and liver and fat and bone, all the organs, that's the players in the orchestra, the violins, the cellos, you know, the clarinets. And so the central clock somehow coordinates and synchronizes all of the peripheral clocks. But the peripheral clocks can be also affected by hormones and nutrients and, you know, exercise, what you do. And these clocks, they're what they're called is a transcription translation feedback loop. And what that means is that they are oscillating throughout the day, and they have an activating arm that turns on the expression of genes, and they have a repressing arm that shuts off the expression of genes. And so they're producing transcripts that can, you know, lead to the production of proteins that can control metabolic processes or biological processes. And it turns out thousands of genes that are controlled by the clock are related to metabolism and growth. And so it's one way in which the body can regulate metabolic and growth processes.
Yep. And is it true that, just like I was thinking about how, you know, if you, it's a bit gross for some people, but, you know, if you kill a rat or a mouse, you take its heart out, it's still beating you. It's the same sort of thing with the clocks. You can change your central, yeah, but your peripheral may be still ticking away and have a different sort of time course. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, I mean, every cell in the body has this clock. And so hormones and nutrients can synchronize the clock so they're aligned, so they can be working in concert. So you're right. If you would take a muscle biopsy from me or you and make primary, you know, myotube cultures, every one of those cells has got their own clock.
Yes.
And they're not really aligned. And so what we use in the dish is we can synchronize these clocks in these myotubes by using serum shock, for example. And then all the clocks are aligned. They get reset. They get reset and they get aligned. And that in some ways is what the central clock can help to do, is to realign all the clocks in the body. And I suppose it's like when you travel, right? You get jet lagged and your clocks, there's a mismatch between the clock, the peripheral clocks and the central clock. And it almost takes one day for every hour of time change before these clocks can be realigned. And so it takes a little bit of time before the light cues can start to realign clocks when you have time changes through seasonal changes or traveling.
Okay, great. So I often think about animal versus human models. How good are the animals? So obviously a lot of that stuff with the Nobel Prize, et cetera, would be using, you know, a lot of stuff would have gone into it, but
well, that was flies. Genes, actually, no, they studied flies. Okay, so they basically studied flies and they snipped off the head of the fly. So they studied the brain, if you could say. They studied the heads of flies. So why mice? You know, and mm-hmm. if you think about it, most, you know, the genome of mouse and human is really similar. Clearly, there's differences between mice and humans, but, you know, mice have brains, they have hearts, they have cardiovascular systems, they have a skeletal system. So many of the the organs are very mm-hmm. similar to humans.
Yep.
And, you know, a lot of the biological processes are very similar as well. And so a mouse is a good model. Obviously, one should strive to do as much work as one can do in humans, obviously. But certain things you can't do in humans as well, like, you know, take the hypothalamus of a human and grind exactly. it up and study it. I mean, you're not going to get my hypothalamus, right? So mice are really good models. And then obviously you want to try to translate as much of that biology to humans as possible.
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff we've done sort of knocking out the clock genes and things, which you obviously can't do in humans. But does the research find that things go hand in hand generally, that what's found, so with the clock regulation, I know it's a bit tricky because they're nocturnal,
but the thing here is that this clock machinery is evolutionarily conserved. It's pretty remarkable, actually. So in that respect, I think that it's an evolutionarily conserved biology. And you're right, mice are nocturnal. So they're active during the dark cycle and sleeping during the light cycle. So there's differences. There's certainly differences in the way metabolism is, you know, performed in a mouse. Mice are very hepatic centric. There's a lot of reliance on the liver in a mouse. The melatonin axis is different in mice and humans, but it's a good model to study.
Yeah.
And I guess the good thing in our lab is that we really can study people. Distinct in that we're able to study molecules. We're able to study cells. We study primary cultures and immortalized cell lines. We study organs. We can take an organ out of a human or an animal and we can study it in a dish. We study mouse models where we can genetically modify the mouse to ask whether or not a particular factor is important for metabolism or the development of diabetes. And we have a clinical lab where we're bringing folks into the lab and we're doing intervention studies. And we're actually asking some of these questions about time of day of exercise in people who have normal glucose tolerance or people who are diabetic, people who have type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, I think it's perfect. I mean, we had similar, I didn't have as much success as you, but doing as much as you can in humans and then try and supplement it with animals and things, which doesn't always happen in a lot of labs. So what I want to talk about there is what does happen then if we talk about what happens to insulin sensitivity in these people with type 2 diabetes, you know, with, you know, circadian change, like what is going wrong there with them that is related to circadian rhythms, for example?
Well, I mean, that right, there's, I guess the real answer is we don't know, you know, so I'm going to say we don't know why there are some circadian misalignments in people with diabetes or obesity. And, I don't necessarily think it's genetic per se, because clock genes haven't really come up as being genes that are primarily responsible for the development of diabetes or obesity. But I think some of it might be related to some environmental factors. I think some of it might be related to food intake. We talked about that earlier. Mm-hmm. And exercise or the lack of exercise for some people. Clearly, I do believe there's a genetic component to the development of diabetes and obesity. I strongly believe that genes play a big role in determining or influencing whether or not an individual will develop obesity or diabetes or insulin resistance. I believe in that. But I also believe that the environment can strongly influence the course to the development of these cardiometabolic diseases. And so, you know, sleep patterns can affect our metabolism. Mm-hmm. So if we have really disturbed sleep patterns, that can affect this. obviously people who are eating into the late hours of the evening, that can definitely put a strain on our metabolism. And in some cases that can lead to increased levels of glycemia, or blood sugar over the night, which can put a stress on our liver and our islet cells, and also a lack of physical activity. So I think that these things are somehow all collaborating together with this clock and affecting our overall metabolism.
As you say, it's always very difficult to say, like, you know, if a person with diabetes or obese has reduced insulin sensitivity, obviously, you know, how much of it is because they're not as active? How much is it because, you know, they who knows, they have depression, even maybe sleep problems, dietary problems. But I did see, I think you had a paper, disrupted circadian oscillations in type 2 diabetes are linked to altered rhythmic mitochondrial metabolism. So there is actually disrupted oscillations in people. So if you have controls and people with type 2 diabetes, you can see.
So I can tell you about that study. Yeah. So in that particular work, Brendan Gabriel and Ali Alantes were the drivers of that work. And we started out by studying primary muscle cells from people who have normal glucose tolerance or people who have type 2 diabetes. And so we took biopsies and we extracted satellite cells and we grew them in a dish, and we could differentiate myoblasts into myotubes. And we studied these myotube cultures over 54 hours. And we sampled them every 4 hours. And what Brendan and Ali could show was when they measured oxygen consumption, there was a rhythm in the rate of oxygen consumption in the myotube cultures that was circadian. And that rhythm was dampened in the myotube cultures from the people with diabetes, which was surprising. And it is a bit similar to what Patrick Schron has seen in muscle biopsies from healthy people. He sees a rhythm in oxygen consumption rates. And then we did RNA sequencing of the cultures over these 54 hours, which was just pretty massive. And we could see that many of the genes that oscillate in a circadian fashion, there was, you could argue that there was a dampening of that oscillation. The peaks and the troughs of the changes in the gene expression was dampened in the cultures from people with diabetes. And so that implied that there was sort of an intrinsic change in the oxygen consumption that was coupled to the clock in myotube cultures. And so it was something outside of the body. So that could either be an epigenetic phenomenon, but somehow these muscle cultures had a memory for these changes. And that's actually what we're trying to work on now in the lab, is trying to understand why. We don't know why. We're trying to figure that out.
And I wonder if you then exercise these people and then got... Now, so you know how the myotubes maintain their glucose, so that people with diabetes have less insulin-stimulated glucose uptake in the myotubes as well, right? I wonder if you exercise, has anyone looked at that? I think they have, actually. If you exercise people and then look at their myotubes, do you see greater insulin sensitivity in the myotubes like a day later or something?
It's possible. I'm not aware of the work directly. But clearly you can stimulate the cells in the dish with electrical pulses, and you can
exercise the tube. We tried to do that.
So I guess what you're trying to say is that you can exercise away the insulin resistance. And I mean, you know, at least, you know, John Palazzi and Mark Rogers did a study years ago where they brought in people that are having impaired glucose tolerance or people with type 2 diabetes. And they had them do acute exercise, one bout of exercise for an hour, and then they had them exercise every day for a week. And they measured glucose tolerance. And these individuals had a really robust improvement in glucose tolerance after 1 week of exercise. And there were a couple individuals in the cohort. It was a small sampling. I think it was about 9 people. 2 of these people didn't really improve their glucose tolerance as well as the others. And the conclusion there was that they didn't really produce a lot of insulin. Their insulin production was low. And I think what John and Mark concluded was that, you know, in this case, if your islets aren't able to produce insulin, you don't benefit as well from the exercise as somebody who actually still is able to produce insulin and they become more insulin sensitive. So I think, you know, if you are early in the course of the disease or if you're pre-diabetic, I think the exercise can really work to help improve insulin sensitivity in muscle. But it may be that if you become late into the course of the disease, it's very difficult that exercise can completely restore insulin sensitivity.
The insulin secretion side of it.
But exercise does a lot of really important things. It improves your cardiovascular fitness, it improves your strength, it improves your coordination and flexibility. So I mean, I think exercise should be in everybody's program, but the extent to which exercise can cure you from diabetes, I'm not sure that there's evidence that it can completely do that. So we have to keep that in mind.
Yes. And even if you do have diabetes at quite a significant level, that you're not going to get improvements in insulin secretion, for example, it's going to mean you need less drugs, less insulin, less
hypoglycemia. Which is good.
Which is great as well.
Which is good.
Now,
I have to say, I think it's really important for people to understand the genes really do affect our risk for diabetes, mm-hmm. for heart disease, for the development of obesity. Genes matter.
Yep. Now, the other thing I was thinking was how we're talking about how having diabetes can mess up your circadian rhythms or vice versa. Well, the other thing is mucking around with your circadian biology can cause insulin resistance by, for example, shift work, which we touched on a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. So we did a little bit on this and it was quite interesting. And we did 4 days of just switching. So, people mm-hmm. were either awake at day or night, and we actually matched the food intake, matched the sleep and everything, and they became insulin resistant. So, mm-hmm. so that's another thing that messing up your circadian rhythm can cause insulin resistance as well. I'm not sure if you've looked at that at all or.
We haven't looked at that, but I mean, clearly that is really a very interesting observation. And think if you are at risk of developing diabetes and you're a shift worker, then that's probably going to be an exponential risk, right? It'll make it even worse. I mean, other diseases have been linked to this. I mean, cancer has been linked to this shift working as well.
That's true. Yep. All right. So what about, I know the other thing you've looked at a bit here is timing of exercise. So do you want to tell us about that? So in terms of, I guess you've looked at the effect of timing of exercise on insulin sensitivity, but then also maybe performance even. I don't know if you've looked at that much, but
The studies, we've only done a few studies on this. The first study was performed in men with type 2 diabetes. And Mladen Slavic and Brendan Gabriel and Harriet Wahlberg Henriksen are part of that work. And there, what we did was we had these men wear continuous blood glucose monitors. And they had a 2-week run-in period. And then the men were assigned to either morning or afternoon HIIT training. And they did 2 weeks of HIIT training. And it was a Monday, Wednesday, Friday HIIT training. And that they did that, 2 weeks in the morning or 2 weeks in the afternoon. And then there was a 2-week period of like a washout. And then they came back and they did, it was a crossover design. So they did the other training. And the idea here is that the training should improve insulin sensitivity and ergo improve glucose levels. And what we found was that in the afternoon training, we got that effect. The exercise training in the afternoon was associated with a reduction in blood sugar levels in these men and an improvement in their evening sugars as well. But the surprise that we found, I thought it was very surprising, was that the expected result was that we should mitigate this peak in morning glucose. But we actually found that the morning exercise led to a further rise in blood sugar in these men. And that was more evident after the first week of training. After the second week of training, that elevation in glycemia was still there after the morning training, but it wasn't as pronounced. And that was curious, actually. We found that to be really curious. And so, I went through the literature. Actually, Fleming Deli was giving a talk and he was talking about some of Michael Kerr's work. And Michael Kerr and Jerry Raven published a paper in men with normal glucose tolerant or men with type 2 diabetes from 1990. And they didn't call it HIIT training, but it was high intensity exercise performed in the morning. And they were measuring blood sugar and insulin levels continuously after exercise. And in the men with normal glucose tolerance, there was a blood glucose lowering effect of the exercise performed in the morning. But in the men with diabetes, they found what we found. There was an elevation in the blood sugar. And the men became more hyperglycemic after the morning exercise.
Can I ask, how much after the exercise are you talking about? So
they were basically charting them out for the day. You know, so they charted them out for the day. And so what we found was it was in the morning period after the exercise. Mm. And I think it's exactly what you said. I think it's, and this is what Michael Kerr concluded, it's catecholamines. Yeah. And so, you know, I feel that for people who have normal glucose tolerance, I don't think there's a concern. But for people who have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, it may be that there is an alteration in a catecholamine response. And there's a mismatch between the production of glucose from the liver and the uptake of glucose into muscle. Mm. And the liver is not able to shut off hepatic glucose production as rapidly. And therefore, the liver still produces glucose. Plasma levels rise. And you know, there's sort of a disequilibrium there. And that's why I think the individuals have this hyperglycemia after the morning training. And I, you know, even after the second week of training, they were still hyperglycemic. So you could argue, well, you can train it away, but they were not having a blood glucose lowering effect even after the second day of training. So I think you got to have longer periods of time to train that system in.
Well, that's really interesting, because I've had a couple of people on talking about this sort of thing. So Michael Riddell, who's, you know, talking about type 1 diabetes and exercise, and talking about how they have to be, you have to think about their insulin, because after high intensity exercise, their glucose overshoots, goes high, up.
There you go.
But also David Wasserman was on. And yeah, like when you do high intensity exercise, the liver keeps pumping out the glucose. Mm-hmm. What's interesting is the fact that you don't really get that with the afternoon exercise as well. That surprises me.
We didn't get that with the afternoon. So I guess the message is, obviously exercise is really good for all the reasons we talked about earlier: cardiovascular system, for the strength, for the flexibility. One should exercise, but maybe if you have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, maybe an optimal time to exercise, maybe in the afternoon, if you're going to do high intensity exercise or strength training, versus the morning. Mm. But, you know, mostly people can figure these things out for themselves, but that might be some guidance.
Yes. So just to clarify again, in my own mind, so when you look at the thing that people need to understand is that continuous glucose monitoring means you can follow the glucose every 5 minutes, or pretty much whenever you want, for like 24 hours, which, you know, remember.
For 2 weeks, basically. These things work for 2 weeks.
Perfect. Yeah. So it's much better, because remember, we used to always just do clamps. You know, everyone is always doing clamps and oral glucose tolerance tests, which is still, you know, obviously important for different things. But if you want to see what's going on, like for a whole day, after a day, 2 weeks, after a meal, after exercise. So just to clarify, over the whole 24 hours, were they still better off, though, from doing the exercise in the morning, the people with type 2 diabetes? Like, was it just going up after the exercise and then coming down lower?
Yeah, they actually had elevated glycemia in the night, too. And you could argue, well, they exercised in the morning, so how could their blood sugar be higher at night? And that, I mean, again, we did an average over the whole week, but their nocturnal sugars were higher.
Wow.
And it might also be, it may be, and we have to probably test this, if you're not really accustomed to exercising, because these people were exercise naive, and you start having to modify your lifestyle around, you know, getting up a little earlier to go to the gym, to kind of get all your stuff together, that's a bit of a stress on top of a stress.
That's true.
And so it might be that, you know, just even that was, maybe they didn't sleep as well because they knew they had to get up early and get to the gym. I don't know. We have to look into the behavioral things around exercise.
That's true.
There's a lot more going on for folks than just getting on a bicycle and exercising. It's all the stuff around it. So, I mean, the bottom line, I think exercise is important. Any exercise is better than no exercise. You know, there's a study that came out not so long ago from the UK Biobank, and they showed that people who exercise between, I think it was 10 o'clock and 4 o'clock, live longer.
I saw that.
And people who exercised really early in the morning or late in the afternoon, late in the evening, didn't do as well. But people who exercised, anytime you exercise was absolutely better than never exercising.
Exactly.
So first of all, any time of the day was better than not. But if you exercise between 10 and 4, you still were better off in terms of longevity, and you were better off.
I remember thinking the people that exercised early and the people that exercise late maybe don't sleep as much. But I didn't check the paper. but I'm sure they probably control for that.
I mean, they were really clear to say that any of the time of day that you exercise was better than not exercising, but you could optimize the benefit of the exercise by exercising during the, you know, 10 to 4, the daytime.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking if you're exercising like at 6 in the morning, maybe you weren't sleeping much and that mucks up your insulin sensitivity. But I'm sure they would have factored that into it. Now, I know you're getting a bit tight with time here. We talked about a meeting you've got coming up. I don't know if you've looked, but people are going to be interested, as I am, about performance. Do you know much about effective, the time of day on exercise performance?
I mean, that's probably a question other people could really answer. But I mean, clearly, most of the world records are broken in afternoon, evening competition than in the morning competition. And others can talk about that. I mean, I know John Hawley went back and looked at records and found that most of the world records were broke in the afternoon, but talked about Australian athletes. And before this last Olympic, the Australian swimmers started to train so that they could optimize their performance for morning performance because the time trials were in the afternoon and the finals were in the morning. And by just changing their training routines, they were still able to break a lot of records and do really well and get a lot of medals. So, I mean, there may be an intrinsic clock that's there because we have a waking period, and maybe 6 hours after we're waking is maybe the most optimal time for us to be strong, right? I'm just throwing 6 hours out there, and you might be able to train that in by getting up earlier and, optimizing for that performance.
All right, this is great. I was just wondering about some other things. So what about, is there any sort of signs of differences between the sexes in any of these sort of things we've discussed?
We actually have just completed a really large study with 100 individuals. And half of these individuals are men and half are women. And out of that 100, half of the individuals have type 2 diabetes and half have normal glucose tolerance. And we have published some of the data on the muscle transcriptome of the men, and we're working up the data on the women right now. And one of the biggest things we found was that in response to an acute bout of exercise, one bout of cycling for 30 minutes at 85% max heart rate, the people with diabetes, the men with diabetes, had a signature in their muscle that was more of an inflammatory response. And we were surprised by that. And it was more pronounced in the men with diabetes. And we've just looked at the data yesterday. I looked at the data in the females and the women. And we see the similar response in the women when they respond to exercise as well, that the women with diabetes have a more marked signature of an inflammatory response. And that might be a good thing, because you have this inflammation and then you can have repair. Mm-hmm. And that might be one of the early changes that one has with exercise. And so we're interested in that. We're also interested in the epigenomic signature and how exercise might modify the epigenome. That's an area of science in the lab that we're running in parallel with some of the clock work. And in that work, we're also asking whether or not women versus men have a difference in the way exercise modifies the epigenome. So in some cases, there's things that are very, very similar. And in some cases, you see some real differences between the sexes. And we're obviously curious about that. The other thing we're interested in, particularly in women, is, and I don't have data yet, but I'm interested in the question, women who are of a younger age, who are still menopausal and who are menstruating, and women who are of a older age who are menopausal, and how that period of life affects the muscles' ability to adapt to exercise and the role of estrogens there. I don't have a lot of data, but we're interested in that. We're really interested in the genomics of skeletal muscle plasticity in the lab.
I guess I was wondering that when you said there wasn't as many differences between male and female, I was thinking, well, I wonder if they were postmenopausal. So that's probably what you're thinking there, that I guess they'd be more similar if they're postmenopausal perhaps.
Well, and that's the population that we have now is a group of men and women who are, between 50 and 65, because the primary question has been exercise as a medicine to promote insulin sensitivity. And so we're doing a multi-omic study where we're looking at the transcriptome. We have data now in-house from the metabolome, and we're putting that together, and also some post-translational modifications. So we're really interested in the layers of changes. Again, it's not one dimension. It's multiple things that are happening.
Mm. Again, it's interesting. You know how you said they're showing some sort of inflammatory response in the muscle. Mm-hmm. And then you said earlier that these people that weren't used to exercise that had type 2 diabetes had, you know, responses with their glucose that were a bit surprising. So I wonder if, as you alluded to, if they did more exercise, you know, I wonder if the same thing's going on. But I guess it wouldn't explain the morning and evening. It wouldn't explain the morning and afternoon, though.
Well, I mean, a training study is warranted. And I mean, the other is the modality of exercise, you know, so maybe, you know, you can imagine maybe low intensity exercise in the morning, high intensity exercise in the afternoon. I mean, these questions need to be addressed, and they're of relevance for people who have cardiometabolic disease.
All right. So just looking at the time here. So is there any controversies in the field that we need to bring up? Because sometimes I have people on and they sort of say everything, and then later on you go, hang on, other people don't sort of think that way. Is it pretty everyone pretty much in agreement on, do you know what I'm saying? So sometimes you might have someone on and they give you their side of it, and then later on you realize there's, I think it's pretty uniformly accepted, and there's been a Nobel Prize, that circadian biology has big effects on metabolism, and we're looking at performance as well. So is that fair to say?
Well, the controversy, if you want to call it controversy, I always think that controversy is usually a sign that we just don't know enough about the biology, you know, and there's a lot of different ways to ask the question. So I think that it just is a sign that we need to know more. And I truly don't think that
it's not very controversial.
All of what we do is definitive answers. I mean, otherwise,
question.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, we should have put science away 100 years ago. I mean, we're always learning new things.
Exactly.
And so, to me, it's an evolution. And I mean, okay. So there's certain things that are settled science. I mean, I think exercise is good for us. You know, and do we completely understand how that's working? No, we don't. And so you'd probably have people that say, well, it's controversial that exercise is good. You know, my mother's husband says he doesn't want to exercise. He doesn't believe it. You know, okay. So there's a controversy between him and me. So I think there's more we can learn.
Definitely.
And I think to basically say that any one of us has the definitive answer is probably naive. And so particularly when you think about this with the circadian biology, we know that there's a lot of different aspects that can affect the clock. So the time element, you talked about diet. You can talk about specific nutrients. You can talk about exercise. You can talk about the temperature. There's so many things that can affect this. So until we control all of that, you know, it may be difficult to get complete clarity on this. But that's the exciting thing about science, because I think we're all doing this because we want to know more about how these systems are working, whether it's circadian biology or glucose uptake or AMPK. I don't think we know everything about anything yet.
No, and we don't want to be thinking we do either, because obviously at one stage we thought the world was flat, although some people, it's making a bit of a comeback. But right, so just before.
I actually don't, I don't look at things as being contentious, you know, or controversial. I think that we just need to learn more, and we can always understand biology better.
There's a couple of people I've had on, for example. So we had someone talking about keto diets and exercise, and that's like a controversial thing. So if I had one person on, they'd say something, and then another person would say something else. I think this area isn't really like that. So just before.
Well, maybe you should have them on together, and then you can have a debate.
I want to. I actually asked them. They don't want to. I actually want to. Okay, just very final. Is there any way we can just do a quick takeaway messages? So, you know, when you give a talk, you think, there's a couple of things I want people to take away from the chat. Is there a couple of two or three takeaway things?
Yeah, I think, all right, one thing I would say is that many of us are reductionists and we look at one molecule at one time. And I think biology is a lot more complex. There is a whole orchestration of signaling pathways and post-translational modifications and gene regulatory processes that are going on. So it's complex. And we also look at snapshots. Most people look at one little snapshot, and things are changing over the course of a day. And, you know, couple days. So we need to really look at the dynamic, especially when we study metabolism. We need to look at the dynamic changes that occur. And we kind of have to take the blinders off and look beyond one molecule, one pathway, one time point, because it's very complex. And that is exciting, because we now are all getting tools in our hands to be able to get an understanding of the complexity and trying to look at the four dimensions of metabolism and how that affects our risk for disease and our ability to prevent disease. So I think this is a really, really cool time that we're in right now.
What are the four dimensions?
Well, I mean, time is for sure one. Mm-hmm. Space is another, right? Mm-hmm. You know, what is it going to be? Temperature, you know, you can have that as well, because you can just put that into a reaction that can catalyze things. Space.
Yeah.
And where are things located in a cell? I mean, you study AMPK, you grind up your cell and you measure AMPK. But where is the location of AMPK in the cell? Tell me about that. Most of us don't even know that. We just grind up a biopsy, throw something on a gel and say it's changed.
Exactly. So I had Neil Zortenblad on here talking about muscle glycogen and fatigue and things. And you need to know what's happening in the different compartments of the cell.
Location matters, right?
Location, yeah. Location. Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming on. And I'm glad you said that at the end with the takeaway, because everything is integrative. We are very integrative, and exercise is integrative physiology at its best. So I appreciate your time, and thanks again. See you. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.